my former teacher, Dr. Fionnuala Doyle O'Neill, as we go into Programme 1 of The Road to the Vote, The Fight for Female Suffrage in Ireland.
Hello, my name is Dr. Fionnuala Doyle O'Neill, and I'm a broadcast historian with the School of History at University College Cork.
I am standing on the shoulders of the ones who came before me. I am stronger for their courage. I am wiser for their words.
Those wonderful words, I'm standing on the shoulders of the ones who came before me. These lead us gently and very provocatively into our series, The Road to the Vote in Ireland, The Fight for Female Suffrage, from 1917 to 1918. Now, following on from the 1916 centenary celebrations, fortunately, there has been a huge willingness to embrace the role played by women in Ireland's military and constitutional politics. We've all heard tell of the role of the rebel women of 1916, women such as the illustrious Countess Constance Markievicz, Helena Maloney, Margaret Skinner, Dr. Kathleen Lynn, and the almost 500 women in total who fought valiantly at the GPO and in the College of Surgeons, and of course at many other outposts throughout Dublin City. Now, while many were imprisoned, none of them died during the Rising. In fact, many went on to live for Ireland, battling tides of hostility in their quest for equality for Irish women. Of course, none of them have become martyrs in the same way as the executed leaders of the 1916 Rising. Yet, many of these women continued the fight, and from 1917 to 1918, some became involved in the suffrage movement and fought for the constitutional freedom for women to vote. This radio series, just charted by me, will chart this arduous and difficult journey of the Irish suffragettes as they fought for the right to vote. Now let's look back at the development of the suffrage movement in Ireland. It begins in the latter part of the 19th century with such figures as Anna and Thomas Haslam, both Quakers, the former a Munster woman from Youghal and County Cork, and Isabella Todd, a Unionist woman from Belfast. The organisations, generally speaking, used passive lobbying tactics. Now the question was whether militant activity or more passive lobbying political work should be used, was just one of the many decisions that the movement had difficulties in having an opinion on. However, between 1912 and 1914, there were 36 convictions of women who committed symbolic actions, and many of them went on hunger strike. One incident occurred when two English women, members of the Women's Social and Political Party, threw a hatchet, no less, at the carriage of the then Prime Minister, Asquith, and John Redmond was also travelling in his visit to Dublin in 1912. According to Rosemary Cullen Owen's book, Smashing Times, A History of the Irish Women's Suffrage Movement, these two women were the only ones to be force-fed while on hunger strike in Irish jails. Then, of course, we had the Irish Women's Franchise League, which was formed in 1908 by Hannah Sheehy Skeffington, Margaret Cussons and others. All of them wanted a distinct militant Irish organisation, which was committed to women's rights and Irish independence, and they wanted to ensure that the Home Rule Bill would incorporate votes for women. Many have heard of Sylvia Pankhurst, the British suffragette. She had close links with the Irish organisation. And there's indeed many correspondence in the National Library from Sylvia Pankhurst to Hannah Sheehy Skeffington. Now at this time, the UVF and the Irish Volunteers in Belfast were preparing themselves for civil war, arming themselves to the teeth. At that time, they condemned as outlandish the violent actions carried out by the suffragettes. It is important to note that the term suffragette was actually quite a demeaning and cynical word used by the Daily Mail to ridicule the women in the suffrage movement who used extreme tactics to make their voices heard. and the women took up this name. I prefer to use the word suffrage in this series when referring to Irish female suffragettes. Now, Hainisí Skeffington is someone we will focus on later on in this series. She played a major role in the suffrage movement and also in the labour movement in Ireland, but is often written about only in reference to her husband Frank, who was a pacifist, and he too was involved in the suffrage movement in Ireland. He was shot dead by a British officer in 1916. This lack of historical reference to the Irish suffragette movement is evident in Jonathan Barton's book, The History of Ulster. The suffragettes get just one mention when he writes.
The suffragettes too were bringing their campaign to a crescendo. In Ulster, they burned Major General Sir Hugh McCallum's home worth £11,000. Orlando House, which is one of the palaces of the Catholic Bishop of Down, and set fire to the tea house at Bellevue, Annadale Hall, and the pavilion of the Cahill Bowling and Tennis Club.
This absence of women in Ireland's political history was, up until the current centenary commemorations, a cultural legacy that is now gradually, but very, very slowly, being challenged and changed. Indeed, when the First World War broke out, the suffrage movement in Ireland divided into several camps. Firstly, there were those women who saw the war as an opportunity to attack England. They wanted much more than just the Home Rule that the Bill of 1914 offered, but rather complete independence for Ireland. For James Connolly and those who supported his views, that meant a socialist, united Ireland. Then, of course, there were the women who put their energies into collecting for the war effort and for charitable work. They collected money for all kinds of war relief.
The Irish Women's Suffrage and Local Government Association included amongst its list of works the establishment of an emergency fund for Belgian refugees in Ireland, women's patrols in Dublin and Belfast, an Irish advisory committee for the prevention and relief of distress caused by war, and various other activities, including the endowment of a bed in the Dublin Castle Red Cross Hospital.
Hundreds of young women were employed in war relief work in Dublin and in branches throughout the country. This caused friction between those who believed that this was a negation of the true suffrage policy. Suffrage first and foremost, they cried. It also caused problems for those committed Republicans, such as Cork woman Mary MacSweeney, yes, sister of Terence MacSweeney. She broke with the suffrage movement when the Munster Women's Franchise League bought an ambulance and presented it to the military authorities in Cork. She came to the conclusion that they were
Britain's first, suffragists second, and Irish women perhaps a bad third.
Thirdly, and most importantly, there were those suffragists in the movement who were opposed to the war and were politically activated against the war. In the suffrage movement, they had been in contact with women on an international scale, with women in Germany and America and other places. A manifesto was issued by the International Suffrage Alliance, which was printed in the Irish Citizen, a hugely important journal edited by Hannah Sheehy Skeffington and used as the organ of the suffragette movement. So just before the outbreak of the First World War, a section of the manifesto read,
"Whatever its result, the conflict will leave mankind the poorer, will set back civilization, and will be a powerful check to the gradual amelioration in the condition of the masses of the people, on which so much of the real welfare of nations depends." Those in the Irish Women's Suffrage League were close to the position of Sylvia Pankhurst in England when they stated that they were opposed to this war, as we are opposed to all war, because we are profoundly convinced that war in itself is an unmitigated evil and the greatest existing menace to true human progress. It is our conviction that feminism and militarism are natural-born enemies and cannot flourish on the same soil.
An Irish branch of the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom was established and carried on peace propaganda during the war years. Of course, attempts were made to have an international peace congress in The Hague in 1915. Of seven Irish women, only the suffragist, Louis Bennett, was given a travel permit. In any event, only 24 delegates from England got permits, and only one or two Englishwomen reached The Hague. This extreme hostility to the suffragettes was further evidenced when the British Admiralty banned all passenger traffic on the day that most women were to travel. A protest meeting was organised in Dublin, at which both James Connolly and Thomas McDonagh spoke. Both went on, of course, to be signatories of the 1916 proclamation. The historian Rosemary Cullen Owens makes the point that from this time onwards, the conflicting ideals of war and militarism and feminism versus pacifism were viewed not just in the European context, but also in the developing militaristic atmosphere of Ireland. Most Irish suffrage societies now remained in existence during the war, and the Irish Catholic Women's Suffrage Association was formed in 1915. Now in Belfast, things were different. The fight for the vote had gone from hot to cold. The women's suffrage movement there, with its base in England, abandoned its militancy as a direct response to the outbreak of the war. This was regretted by many, including one of the principal Ulster feminists, L.A. Priestley McCracken.
When the first cannon shot crashed through the peace of Europe, the world of women's suffrage was shaken to its depths. Its organisation, its funds, its raison d'etre seemed threatened and unstable. Some suffragettes became war partisans, some became peace partisans.
It must be noted, of course, that suffrage work went on in Ireland during the war years, but many in the North who were opposed to the war were considered to be unpatriotic and actively dwindled. Political divisions were coming to the fore with the Irish Women's Franchise League and their paper, The Irish Citizen. This became an increasingly pacifist and sympathetic voice towards Irish separatism. In England, much of the main branch of the Women's Social and Political Union threw itself behind the war effort. They demanded conscription for men and women, and they changed the name of their paper from Suffragette to Britannica. Sylvia Pankhurst stood solidly with the Socialists of Europe and others. She had already been set apart from her own organisation when she worked with working class women in the East End of London and also gave support to the Irish labour movement. She stood on a platform with James Connolly, Delia Larkin and others demanding the release of Jim Larkin when he was given 7 months imprisonment for seditious language in 1913. A year before the start of the war, there had been a massive labour struggle in Dublin when Jim Larkin, James Connolly, Delia Larkin, Helena Maloney and others were organising the trade union movement in Ireland with the Irish Transport and General Workers Union. The fight for organised labour was beginning to move gently forward, and it was in 1911 that hundreds of women from Jacob's Biscuit Factory came out on strike, and the Irish Women's Workers Union was established in 1911. Maria Luddy's book, Women in Ireland, A Documentary History, gives some of the original documents from the struggles at that time, including a report from the Irish Worker of 15-year-old girls from Pembroke Laundry who went out on strike after one had been dismissed. 14 of these women had joined the Irish Women's Workers' Union 2 weeks previously. In 1913, William Martin Murphy, chairman of the Employers' Federation, led the Capitalists of Dublin. He was perceived as the richest man in Dublin. He owned the Irish Independent newspaper and the tram company. In 1913, along with other employers, he locked the workers out of their jobs because they refused to sign a form to say that they would not join the union. According to Thomas A. Jackson in his book, Ireland Her Own,
to follow the struggle in detail would require a volume. What is significant for our purposes is that the working classes of Dublin found themselves faced with an alliance of Dublin Castle, the Orange Tory magistrates, the nationalist employers, and the Catholic hierarchy. To make the united front of reaction complete, Arthur Griffiths denounced Larkin unsparingly in the name of Sinn Féin.
In real terms, thousands of people were without money, and people such as Constance Markovich, Delia Larkin and others wanted to help some of the starving strikers' children. Teresa Moriarty, in Donal Neville's book, James Larkin, Line of the Field, says,
Delia Larkin and Grace Neal oversaw a staff of 22 people preparing 3,000 breakfasts at Liberty Hall every morning and providing clothing for more than 3,000 children and babies. They serve free dinners to nursing mothers from mid-December until the end of February.
In fact, listeners, this tremendous labour struggle is worth viewing in the RTÉ drama series Strumpet City, which was made in 1969 and which is based on James Plunkett's novel. This gives a very vivid and emotional overview of the 1913 lockout. However, in order to put into context the rise of the women's suffrage movement in Ireland, it is important to note that there was a burning anger by women regarding the notion of sending strikers' children to homes in England so that they could be fed. Because women had no vote and thus could not articulate their views within a parliamentary chamber, it fell to the poet and writer George Russell. He made a memorable speech in the Albert Hall in London. There he demanded the immediate release of Jim Larkin, who had been imprisoned as the ringleader of the 1913 lockout, and as Russell spat out his words, he said,
"Men who have so little concern for the human body at all, that they assert it is better for children to be starved than to be moved from the Christian atmosphere of the Dublin slums. You have no idea what the slums of Dublin are like. There are more than 20,000 families, each living in one room."
James Connolly and others also wrote about the wrath of the Catholic Church and the hostile community reaction to the strikers as they attempted to send the children away from their Catholic homes. Indeed, W.B. Yeats wrote,
"I want to know why the mob of the North Wall and elsewhere were permitted to drag children from their parents' arms, and by what right one woman was compelled to open her box and show her marriage certificate. I want to know by what right the police have refused to accept charges against these rioters."
It was obvious there was collusion between the police and the Catholic Church and the so-called good people of Dublin, who turned into mobs and by force prevented these children from leaving a starving Dublin. A small number, however, did leave for England. Three strikers were killed during the lockout, one being Alice Brady. Just at 14 years old, she was shot by a dissident. Teresa Moriarty writes in her book, Lion of the Fold,
"Dublin women workers paid a high price in the lockout. Between 400 and 500 women never got their jobs back. They had been arrested and imprisoned."
To protect the workers, Larkin, Connolly, Markovitch and others formed the Irish Citizen Army in 1913 as a disciplined group, the first workers' army in Europe and the first to allow women members. John Cassidy, a 33-year-old Protestant from Dublin and said to be a member of the Irish Republican Brotherhood, the GAA and the Orange Order, along with the Irish Transport and General Workers' Union, was later to become known as Sean O'Casey. He described the night that the Irish Citizen Army was formed.
"The city was surging with a passion full of daring and fiercely expectant, a passion strangely enjoyable which I had never felt before with such intensity and emotion. It was felt, unconsciously, that this struggle would be the Irish Armageddon between capital and labour."
Teresa Moriarty writes in her book, Lion of the Fold, "The Irish Citizen Army opened its membership to women and it became one of the fighting forces in the 1916 Rising. On the war, James Connolly's famous slogan was, 'We serve neither King nor Kaiser, but Ireland.' Connolly passionately and fervently believed in equality for women and their right to vote. And it was with his support that the Irish suffrage movement felt emboldened. In our next programme, we look at the history of the suffrage movement and one of its pioneering women, Anna Haslam.
I am standing on the shoulders of the ones who came before me. I am stronger for their courage."
Well, folks, I hope you enjoyed the first programme. We're going to go straight in now onto the topic of the genteel suffragist Anna Haslam, ni Anna Fisher, who was a Quaker woman originally from Youghal in County Cork, and her pacifist husband Thomas Haslam. They were both committed to universal justice and human rights. Areas of discussion in this programme include the concept of philanthropy, the controversial Contagious Diseases Act in 1864 and its consequences for women, as well as the efforts of Haslam to opt for a more pacifist form of suffragism. So enjoy this, folks, as we return to The Road to the Vote, the fight for female suffrage in Ireland, presented by Dr. Fionnuala Doyle O'Neill.
Hello. My name is Dr. Fionnuala Doyle O'Neill, and I'm a broadcast historian with the School of History at University College Cork.
We are standing on the shoulders of the ones who came before us. They are saints and they are human. They are angels, they are friends.
In the aftermath of the 1916 Rising and of the general militancy, which finally led to the establishment of the Irish Free State, the quiet revolutionaries were forgotten, sidelined, especially if they were women. Fortunately, they are now being recovered, and there have been many female historians, such as Maria Luddy, Carmel Quinlan, and many more, who have reimagined these women back into our national narrative. Today's programme looks at some of those quiet revolutionaries who battled for the female vote in Ireland. We begin today's journey with Anna Haslam. In 1854, when she was just 25 years of age, Anna Haslam went to live for a few years in Marfield in Clonmel, County Tipperary. Her biographer, Dr. Carmel Quinlan, has described her as genteel. And yet, she has become one of the most important revolutionaries in the long campaign for women's rights. Anna Haslam, similar to many Irish female pioneers, was also middle class. Though many other campaigners at that time would not have been Quakers, but rather Protestant. It must be remembered also that Ireland was part of the United Kingdom at that time, and all laws focused on improving the role of women required legislation by an all-male parliament based at Westminster in London. Another interesting point for many of you to note is that for many nationalists, female suffrage and the battle for the vote was more of an English feminist campaign. Therefore, Irish Catholic women were more likely to be active in issues such as Catholic emancipation, the Fenians and the Ladies' Land League. I suppose it is of interest that Haslam had, from a very early age, been a member of the anti-slavery movement and of what they called the Olive Leaf Circle, an organisation dedicated to the promotion of international peace. For Anna, however, she gradually became aware of the more immediate problems on her own doorstep. These involved, for instance, family planning, a subject then not widely discussed, and upon which her husband was to write a rather innocent, but back then quite radical, pamphlet. Looking at the limited and rather confined conditions of women's lives, particularly poor women, led Anna inevitably to the suffragette movement. It was contrary to her whole sense of social justice that women had neither a vote nor a representation in elections, and thus had neither influence nor power in the enactment of the laws which governed their lives. Unfortunately for Haslam, the intensive pursuit of votes for women was set back 10 years by the enactment of the very controversial Contagious Diseases Act in 1864. This legislation allowed for the imprisonment of women, alleged prostitutes, without trial, and for indefinite periods of time, in the so-called lock hospitals. The basic injustice of imprisonment without trial and the double standard of morality implicit in the legislation. The fact that women were treated as commodities to serve as army men and navy men wherever they were stationed angered many women and politicised a significant number of well-educated middle-class women, including, it has to be said, a limited number of Catholic women. the campaign for the repeal of the legislation, much of it led by both of the Haslams, was intensive. It necessitated countless meetings, lobbying, placarding, and letters to newspapers. The campaigners were derided, abused, condemned, and accused of supporting the dregs of society. However, victory was achieved in the repeal of the Acts of 1882. Even though Haslam was active in many campaigns vital to women's advancement, she's perhaps best remembered today for her work for Votes for Women. She had been associated with the English suffragette movement from 1866. The parliamentary vote was important both as a recognition of women's equal citizenship as well as empowering them to reform society through influencing legislation. In 1867, in Britain, the vote to extend the male franchise to women failed, despite the gathering of 1,500 signatures. Some years later, in 1876, Anna established, along with her husband Thomas, the Dublin Women's Suffragette Association, which later branched out into a national movement. By the end of the 19th century, no progress had been made on parliamentary franchise for women. There was, however, developments in the area of local government. It had become a political issue in Britain. Here in Ireland, with the setting up of the poor law system in 1838, it was said that now, this was the time at the end of the century for women to put themselves forward for the office of poor law guardian. Now this had obvious potential for Irish philanthropists as a way of sharing in policy making. Anna Haslam and the Dublin Women's Suffragette Association immediately set about organising the introduction of a private members' bill to remove disqualification, and I quote, by sex or marriage. These conditions had previously excluded women from being elected as poor law guardian. The bill was passed in 1896, and by the year 1900, there were 100 women guardians. Such an achievement. The Irish Local Government Act was to follow soon after. And while women in England and Northern Ireland had, in 1887, won the vote in municipal elections, in Ireland, eligibility for women to be elected to county councils did not come until 1911. Anna Haslam was prescient. She saw the Local Government Act, and as I quote, the most significant political revolution that has taken place in the history of Irish women, unquote. Very strong words. But to her mind, it did open up unprecedented opportunities for women to participate in public political life. But even more importantly for Haslam, it would encourage more women to join the campaign for the Vote for Women. Now by 1912, many new recruits had joined the suffrage movement. Some were active in cultural revival, such as Maud Gonne. Some had university degrees. An example would be Professor Mary Hayden of University College Dublin, and the future founders of the militant Irish Women's Franchise League, Hannah Sheehy Skeffington and Margaret Cotton. To them we turn later on in our next programme. Haslam was secretary of the Dublin Women's Suffrage Association from the beginning until 1913, when she stood down and was elected life president. The original membership was predominantly Quaker and included both men and women, though gradually women outnumbered men and became involved in what we call soft campaigning, educating public opinion through letters to newspapers and organising drawing room and public meetings. The pursuit of votes for women had taken up a lot of energy, and the association retained strong contacts with both the suffragette movements in Britain and internationally. Interesting to note that both Thomas and Anna would regularly travel abroad to suffragette and other feminist conferences and later to suffrage demonstrations and parades. Thomas Haslam, as would later be the case with Frank Sheehy Skeffington, was one of many enlightened men who supported the campaigning women. Men who identified the injustice of depriving one half of humanity of a democratic right. It should also be said that the Haslam campaign was entirely peaceful. Mrs. Pankhurst and her militants were still some decades into the future. The partial victory achieved in 1898, when women over 30 were allowed to vote in local elections, was not enough. 20 years later, however, in 1918, when Anna Haslam was 90 years of age, women received the vote. Her biographer, Carmel Quinlan, describes the scene when Haslam, after 40 years of suffrage activity, exercised her vote.
She was surrounded by flowers and flags. She was driven by motor car to vote and was filmed by a news camera crew.
The battle for the vote was finally won, but her beloved Thomas had now died. Universal suffrage for all citizens, men and women over 21, became a vital component of the first constitution of the new Irish state. But it would turn its back on its commitments to women and ignore their participation in Irish political life. Anna Haslam died on the 28th of November 1922, by which time the country which she loved so much was in turmoil, on the brink of civil war. She wrote,
"It is miserable, strikes innumerable. What will become of us? Ireland is a puzzle."
She said of herself that her life had been spent in assisting all movements which helped to forward the interests of women, and she certainly did that. Her contribution to the development of Irish feminist activism was enormous, as was that of the suffragette movement she founded. Though she herself was a unionist and from a Quaker background, she successfully drew nationalist, Catholic and socialist young women into the suffrage movement, such as lesser known Irish suffragette, Cork woman Suzanne Day. Day was not the only active member of the Munster Franchise League. Cork suffragist Mary McSweeney, sister of the martyred Terence, former Lord Mayor of Cork, was also a member. Staying with our Munster connections, writer and novelist Edith Somerville from Castle Townsend, West Cork, was also a member of the Munster Franchise League. Early suffragism was genteel and non-militant. Much of this was to change, however, as we chart the rise of the Irish Women's Franchise League in 1908 and the role of one of its key members, Hannah Sheehy Skeffington. As Margaret Cussons, co-founder of the Irish Women's Franchise League, recorded in its minute book, now housed in the National Library, to that dear old leader of the constitutional suffragettes, unquote, to explain they wanted a more Irish organisation and one prepared to use militant needs if necessary. Anna Haslam said she regretted their actions, but as the minute book states, they agreed to differ on means, though united in arms and ideals.
Well, folks, we're going to go straight into Programme 3 of The Road to the Vote, and this will look at some enlightening interviews with University College Cork Women's Studies lecturer Dr. Sandra McAvoy about her pioneering research into long-forgotten Cork suffragist and political activist Suzanne Day and her role in the Munster Franchise League. Other Munster-based suffragists under discussion in this programme include Mary McSweeney, sister of the martyr Terence McSweeney, and the novelist and dramatist Edith Somerville from Castle Townsend in West Cork, well known for her novels The Irish R.M. and The Real Charlotte, co-written with her cousin Violet Martin. So we return for the last time this week to The Road to the Vote, the fight for female suffrage in Ireland.
Hello, my name is Dr. Fionnuala Doyle O'Neill, and I'm a broadcast historian with the School of History at University College Cork.
We are standing on the shoulders of the ones who came before us. They are saints and they are human. They are angels, they are friends.
Those wonderful words I'm standing on the shoulders of the ones who came before me. These lead us gently and very provocatively into our series, The Road to the Vote in Ireland, the Fight for Female Suffrage. Let us focus on the lesser known suffragists, in particular those from the Munster region. I speak, of course, of Suzanne Day, Mary McSweeney, and the novelist Edith Somerville. I am joined by Dr. Sandra McAvoy of the Women's Study Department at University College Cork. She has done some pioneering work on Suzanne Day and will now tell us something of her.
Suzanne was the daughter of a wealthy Cork businessman, and her father was also a well-known archaeologist and antiquarian. She was very highly educated. One night in autumn 1910, she attended a suffrage meeting in Cork City Hall, at which, as she later said, Mrs. Pankhurst put a match to the suffrage campaign in Munster. She was there as a guest of Hannah Shee Skeffington's Irish Women's Franchise League. And after the meeting in Cork, a branch of the League was set up in the city, with Suzanne as honorary secretary. But in early 1911, the Cork women decided that the militancy of the Skeffington organisation wouldn't work in Cork. They changed the name of the organisation to the Munster Women's Franchise League, and they made clear that they were non-militant suffragists rather than militant suffragettes. Well, it's difficult to know how many members they had. We do know that in the first year they had 200 members. They worked very hard at expanding the women's movement across the south. They collected funds and they set up a permanent office in Cork City. They developed branches in places like Skibbereen, County Cork, Limerick and Waterford cities, Nenagh, County Tipperary, Tralee and Valentia in Kerry. One of the interesting things when you look at their meetings is that a number of prominent men in Cork supported them, and amongst them were people like Professor W.F.P. Stockley of UCC, who later became a Sinn Féin TD, and he sometimes spoke at the meetings. Many people who might have differed in their political party opinions came together to work to get women the vote, and Suzanne also wrote about the Munster League involving intense unionists and Sinn Féiners, all of them united in that campaign for the vote. For Suzanne, there seemed to be a huge amount of enjoyment, and I think it's also important to remember that for many of these women, being involved in franchise work was an outlet they hadn't otherwise had. She seemed to very much enjoy speaking at public meetings. She travelled all across Munster to do that. She seems to have been very witty and entertaining and good at dealing with the anti-suffrage hecklers who sometimes tried to cause them trouble. There's one newspaper account that says a gun was fired at one of the Cork meetings. Some of the people opposed votes to women because they were very much afraid that giving them the vote would completely change the political landscape.
Sandra went on to explain that Suzanne had a wealth of talent in other areas.
Well, she had many talents, and many of them come to the fore during her period in the League, maybe because she gets more confident about herself through that involvement. And a number of feminists in that period also began to write novels, write plays, or draw cartoons that helped their political campaigns. And Suzanne began to make her name as a writer during this period too. One of her plays, Broken Faith, was written with another League member, Geraldine Cummins, and it was performed at the Abbey Theatre. Another play, Toilers, was performed in Dublin and Cork, and it was about the low wages paid to women workers that could force them into prostitution. Suzanne Day writes a pamphlet called Women in the New Ireland, which is about her vision of an Ireland under Home Rule in which women and men would have the vote on equal terms. And she felt that it was very important for women to bring their practical skills to dealing with social problems, and that by working together, men and women would create a better society.
Sandra goes on to explain Suzanne's involvement as a poorhouse guardian.
At a time when there were no social welfare payments, people who couldn't find work or were too old or sick to work could become destitute, and the only place in which they could find support was in the workhouse. And the workhouses were grim institutions, that were controlled by boards of guardians. And membership of a board of guardians was the first political position open to women. And Suzanne was one of the first three women elected when the League supported women candidates in the 1911 Poor Law Guardian elections. She and her running mate in her constituency actually topped the poll in the constituency, which I think is an indication of how highly respected they were. Suzanne was also the first woman to stand in a municipal election in Cork in 1914. Unfortunately, it was an election in which there was a political war between the Nationalist Party and William O'Brien's All for Ireland League, and Suzanne was one of the casualties in that war, but she missed a seat by just 6 votes.
Sandra explains to us Suzanne's political journey after her involvement in suffrage.
One of the things about Suzanne is that her involvement in the suffrage movement made her very concerned about social issues, and she seems to have had a very strong social conscience. And we see that first in her work as a poor law guardian. Her novel, The Amazing Philanthropists, is a very thinly disguised description of her experiences in trying to persuade the Board of Guardians to make changes in the workhouse. She worked for a very long time trying to get them to increase or to rebuild the children's ward. At one stage, there were 42 children in the ward and 25 beds, and 25 of the children were suffering from TB. So you can imagine how infections were passed on. She was very concerned about the outbreak of war. She saw war in 1914, when the war in Europe began. She saw war as a moral evil. Her parents had died in the summer of 1914, and she actually stepped back from suffrage work, supposedly temporarily. She thought temporarily, partly because of the deaths of her parents, I think, but also her concern for the war led her to speak against the war and to call it an evil that women must resist. Early in 1915, she seems to have seen an advert in a Quaker magazine looking for social workers to go and work with refugees in France. And actually Suzanne left Cork and went to France working with refugees from the battles of the Marne and Verdun. After the war, she settled in England and took up a job as the editor of a feminist magazine in England and made her living as a journalist in the 1920s. She still continued to write plays. She would actually volunteer as an air raid warden in the Second World War when she was in her 60s.
Of course, Suzanne Day was not alone. Mary McSweeney, sister of the martyr Terence, was also an active suffragist, according to Sandra McEvoy.
I suppose today we remember Mary McSweeney best as the sister of Terence McSweeney, the Lord Mayor of Cork, who died on hunger strike in Brixton in 1921. But Mary served as a TD from 1921 to 27, and she's also remembered for her passionate three-hour speech in the Dáil in 1921 when she opposed the Anglo-Irish Treaty. It was a speech made totally without any notes and absolutely from her heart.
It is the women who suffer the most. You would not find in Ireland a woman who has suffered, who today will talk as the soldiers here today have talked. And I ask the Minister of Defence, if that is the type of soldier he has, in heaven's name, send the women as your officers the next time.
Sandra goes on to argue that the movement was not wholly elitist and middle class.
I think as we look more at the movement, we see that a much broader range of women and men as well were involved. And Mary certainly didn't come from a privileged background, but her academic achievements meant that she could be economically independent. Her father and mother had been teachers. Her mother was English, and they met in London. They returned to Ireland and tried to set up a tobacco business, but it failed, and her father emigrated, and her mother became the family breadwinner.
Sandra goes on to explain how Suzanne Day and Mary McSweeney would have met.
They served in the same committee in the Munster Women's Franchise League, and Mary was involved from the beginning in helping to set up the league. So that was how the two of them came into contact through their support for suffragism. Mary McSweeney of her period in the suffrage movement is a different person from the Mary who would come through the Easter Rising, the War of Independence, the death of her brother, and all that all the changes that brought about in her life. She'd never have imagined when she joined the Munster Women's Franchise League that within a decade she'd be at the centre of political life in Ireland and the only member of the league who'd make that journey. And Suzanne Day described her as quite shy and not wanting to be conspicuous in her league days. The passion that she felt by that stage because of what she'd gone through in the years before contributed very much to the person that she became. But at the time of the Munster Women's Franchise League, her focus was on getting women the vote, although she'd been involved in other nationalist organisations, including the Gaelic League. The league is at its strongest between 1910 and 1914, so that is one of the things that brings about the end of her period in the suffrage movement when she moves to a stronger focus on nationalism. But she became engaged in the campaign for the vote because she thought that it was a matter of social justice that women would have the vote, and she very much objected to anti-suffragist arguments that women were intellectually inferior to men and couldn't be trusted with the vote. And it's interesting that one of her early talks with the League suggested that citizens should have to take a course and pass a test before they got the vote, and it would have been one of the ways in which women could have proven that they were equally capable.
Sandra goes on to explain Mary McSweeney's involvement in Cumann na mBan.
Court branch of Cumann na mBan was founded in Mary McSweeney's house, and she and her sister were leading members, and her sister-in-law, Terence's wife, became a leading member as well. I think Mary's period in the Munster Women's Franchise League came to an end shortly after she became involved with Cumann na mBan. She became involved in an argument with the Sheehy's Skeffingtons through their Dublin newspaper, The Irish Citizen. The Sheehy's Skeffingtons were very critical of Cumann na mBan because they saw them as they put it, servile, and blamed them for failing to seek equality with the men in the Irish Volunteers. Mary dealt with that initially quite calmly, but she also warned the Sheehy's Skeffingtons that their attitude would drive nationalist women out of the suffrage movement. She stayed in the Munster Women's Franchise League until after the First War began, but she wrote herself that she tried to interest the members of the League in her brand of nationalism. Women like Suzanne Day and also the League president, Edith Somerville, saw themselves as nationalists, but a different kind of nationalist.
Sandra then went on to speak about Edith Somerville.
We do remember her as a writer who was in partnership with her cousin Violet Martin in writing books like The Real Charlotte and the Irish RM Stories. She grew up in Castle Townsend in County Cork, and she lived the kind of life that women in the gentry class lived. She loved horses and hunting. She was 17 when she had a coming out ball in Cork, and at that time she was very proud of her 18-inch waist.
Sandra went on to explain what the concept of new woman was.
Women who wanted to work and who wanted to be able to live with economic independence, and they didn't want to be dependent on husbands or fathers or brothers. Edith was a talented artist long before she became known as a writer, and she studied in Paris in the 1880s and began to make her living as an illustrator. By the time she was involved with the Munster Women's Franchise League, she was a farmer and made her living from farming and writing.
Sandra went on to explain Somerville's route to political activism.
Well, she had a long history of being involved in the suffrage movement long before she got involved with the Munster Women's Franchise League, and she'd been involved with an English organisation. She didn't favour militant tactics, but she did confide in a letter to her brother that she thought Emmeline Pankhurst's militant women's social and political union had demonstrated how effectively women could organise and carry through the tactics of militants. And she also thought they'd shown that they could stand very firmly in defence of their principles. And she thought militancy had also succeeded in winning support for the women's cause from some working class male voters. She also spoke in public in Cork about how it was the militant suffragettes who placed the question of votes for women centre stage. At the same time, though, she may have influenced the non-militancy of the Cork organisation, because she thought that if women were to win the support of male voters, they had to think about the men in the areas where they were moving. She was very conscious of how every woman could influence the men they knew, and that men's understanding of women as a group.
I wondered why none of these women had been involved in the Irish Citizen Army, and Sandra explained why.
Their sphere was the much more rural Munster area.
Yes.
They
yes.
weren't involved in the labour movement.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. And I think as well, for many suffragists, that was a distraction from the focus on persuading voters to persuade the British government to grant votes to women. For example, these women betrayed, as they thought, by the Nationalist Party of John Redmond, which actually wanted Liberal support for Home Rule and blocked a bill that would have given votes for women in 1912 in order to win the Liberal support for Home Rule.
Sandra goes on to explain what happens to Edith Somerville after her suffrage involvement.
Edith Somerville really doesn't make headlines after 1914, 1915, partly, I think, because the suffrage issue is overtaken by the war, the splits in the women's movement caused by women who supported the war, opposed the war, or took nationalist positions on the war.
Mm-hmm.
So I think some of the power went out of the movement during those years of the war, the 1916, the War of Independence.
Finally, Sandra explains women's attitude to De Valera's 1937 constitution.
We don't focus enough on the women's movement after 1922, when a number of organisations continued to campaign, including the Irish Women Workers' Union and Tánaiste Skeffington's organisation, which became the Irish Women Citizens and Local Government.
Sandra explains the type of political activity taking place between 1920 and 1937.
Tánaiste Skeffington's organisation and the Irish Women Workers' Union both persistently lobbied the government over legislation in the period from 1922 to the passing of the constitution and beyond. They were involved in campaigns to change legislation on sexual crime. They were involved in campaigns on against censorship. There were major issues in relation to women and work that they campaigned on.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there was impetus to the women's movement that continued after 1922, but they were no longer focused on the vote then, and the movement became much more diffuse and focused on the different issues that different women's groups decided were the most important issues for them.
Well, folks, before we conclude this week's programme, I do want to thank Dr. Fionnuala Doyle O'Neill and our friends at University College Cork for allowing us to share some of the fascinating insights into the research on suffragism in Ireland. And indeed, we're going to return to this topic next week. And then the following week, I look forward to sharing with you some aspects of Irish-American participation in the suffrage movement, especially with its intersections in Irish nationalism. Thank you for tuning in to the Glucksmann Ireland House Radio Hour. We're coming towards the end of the programme, and I'm Dr. Miriam Nighan. And again, I'd like to thank you for listening to us here. I'll be back again next Saturday, same time on WNYE 91.5 FM in the tri-state area and worldwide on www.irishradio.com, as well as on www.nyuirish.net/radio hour. In the meantime, if you'd like to get in touch with me or the production team, our email is ireland.house@nyu.edu. We're delighted to come to you every week in collaboration with Irish Radio Network USA, care of Mr. Adrian Flanley. Thanks for tuning in, folks. Have a lovely weekend. As I mentioned earlier, next week we will return to the theme of the suffrage movement in Ireland in particular, and we will be coming to you with some more excerpts from Dr. Fionnuala Doyle O'Neill's The Road from the Vote, which was scripted, researched and presented out of University College Cork in Ireland. So I hope you've enjoyed and found it as insightful as I have in this timely, we're very close to commemorating suffragism in Ireland at the 100-year mark here. And it's really great that we're able to share these insights on this side of the Atlantic about what was evolving in Ireland at that point in time, before we maybe look and see what was going on this side of the Atlantic, in particular in the Irish American community. So thanks for tuning in, folks. Have a lovely weekend. Slán agus beannacht. Our theme music today is the opening set by The Gloaming, produced by Brassland and Real World Records.